On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we react in part to the New York Knicks winning the NBA Finals and speculate which World Series drought ending would be the most significant, looking at the longest active droughts in baseball. We react to a weekend filled with marvelous pitching performances, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, Jacob Mizorowski, and more, before we zoom around the league and recap the rest of the action. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that was locked in to Rays Angels instead of Spurs Knicks. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. It was a historic weekend around the sporting world. We got World Cup frenzy. We got the weirdest UFC event ever. The fireworks, which woke me up last night. We got the Knicks winning it all, and we got the Rays avoiding a sweep in Anaheim on Sunday. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. I already said that. I feel great today because the sun has risen on a country full of sport.
True. I feel less good with you referencing UFC before congratulating the Carolina Hurricanes on winning the Stanley Cup, because I actually watched that and enjoyed it. Unlike that other event. But on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, normally on Mondays, we look around and say, okay, who swept? Who grabbed our attention? Who do we need to talk about because they won all their games over the weekend? Yes, I guess technically the Cleveland Guardians won all two of their games over the weekend. But because we had so much sport happening, because the New York Knicks won their first championship in 53 years, we wanted to have a different kind of conversation about droughts. And that's our opener.
Good things come to those who wait. That is, if you don't die first. Sports fandom functions as pain because every year in every sport, one team wins and 29 or 30, or in our case, soon to be 31 fan bases are usually bummed out at the end, right? The last taste in everyone's mouth is one of sadness. But we are at all times gunning for the glee that these victorious fan bases get to experience when it all goes well. And I think that the New York Knicks captured that essence deeper than any franchise fan base has probably since the Cubs won it all in 2016. The Knicks, who won their first World Series of basketball over the weekend, their first World Series of basketball in 53 years, beating the Spurs in five games. Jalen Brunson, legendary performance from the Knicks guard. And that was cool, what happened on the court. But I think what took this to another level were the raucous celebrations emanating out of New York City. And that inspired us to think about droughts, to think about the fandom desert, to think about the waiting, to think about the explosion of happiness when that waiting finally ends. And so we're going to copy and paste drought chat and bring it to baseball.
Yeah, and I think that drought chat is very interesting in American sporting culture because oftentimes it does involve more than just one team. The Knicks were unique and are unique because of the relationship that they have with the city. There are multiple baseball teams and multiple football teams and technically multiple basketball teams. But in those, moving the Nets to the side, those split fandoms does kind of impact the way, whereas the Knicks are clearly the city's team. Now, I bring that up because we're going to talk about some baseball droughts. And in some cases, these are baseball droughts that are for the city, not that long. And obviously for New York, they have won stuff in the last few decades, of course, with the Yankees and of course with the Giants and so on and so forth. But I do think that I don't think it's irrelevant. The New York Liberty, right? I know that they're it's not irrelevant that, like, the fact that the Yankees also haven't won in a while and the Mets haven't won in a while, and I guess even the Giants have won in a while. I do think that that contributed at least a little bit to how excited all of those fans who are also Knicks fans were for this championship. So that's a little bit of a preamble about how we have this conversation, because we are not experts on all the sports and all the droughts and all the cities. Well, but yeah,
I want to say, just as big as the Yankees are, New York is a Knicks city. And as someone who lived there for 8 years and kind of experienced, spent a lot of time trying to promote baseball to kids, right, in New York, you're fighting against the Knicks, man. Like, the Knicks hold a cultural cachet in that town that is unmatched. Now, part of that is just a space dynamic. Like, it is easier to have a basketball court in the concrete jungle than it is to have a baseball field with turf or grass or whatever. But the Knicks run that town. And so I am immensely happy for many of the people that I met during my time in New York. Like, every single parent of any Little League kid that I coached during my time in Harlem, like, unbelievable Instagrams bubbling up over the weekend. Let's pivot to baseball, because I think the drought conversation is also interesting within the context of what we've had in the 21st century. Three of the longest droughts ever in any sport were all baseball droughts, and were all broken within the last 20 years. That is the Red Sox in 2004. That is the White Sox in 2005. And that is, of course, the Chicago Cubs in 2016, and the Los Angeles Dodgers in 2025. Those fans having to wait 0 years from their last World Series. Tough.
Hey,
long time waiting.
It was. I mean, that stretch in August, though, that was pretty tough for them, and they overcame
was
it.
Tough.
And they were able to get back to the top. So this will not be a Dodgers conversation. Now, as we know, we have had a lot of parity in Major League Baseball. So a lot of teams have had the chance to win. We have had some, maybe not as much recently, a little bit, some more repeat champions, teams like the Giants and, of course, teams like the Dodgers. Astros there multiple times.
Red Sox.
So let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Because
who's waiting? Who's waiting?
Yeah, let's lay out the drought landscape. Okay, because now part of what you just referenced earlier, that we have, well, baseball's also been doing baseball for longer than a lot of these other sports. So they've been a bit of a leg up in terms of these official leagues.
First.
It was much easier. Right. So, which is great. I think that's an advantage that our sport, of course, has is that rich history.
If you're alive longer, you can be sadder for longer.
How fortunate baseball fans are. We're going to focus really on eight droughts, the eight longest droughts, because I do think that these eight franchises and how long they've been waiting all have their own compelling, unique story. We should note that the three longest droughts here that we are going to start with are all longer in progress than the one that the Knicks just ended, right? So the Knicks won their last championship in 1973. Three teams that we will start with, the Cleveland Guardians, who have not won as a franchise since 1948, the Milwaukee Brewers and the San Diego Padres, who both joined Major League Baseball in 1969 and have never won a World Series. That's all.
Never
so there
won.
You go. They got nothing. And then the Mariners, who did not join until 1977, also have never won, famously. But that's, I guess, not as long as the Knicks, so they can't claim quite the same thing. The Mariners have their own argument that we'll get to. And then the other four we're going to talk about are the Pirates, who last won in 1979, the Baltimore Orioles, 1983, the Detroit Tigers, 1984, and of course, those New York Mets, who last won in 1986. Now, there are other droughts in progress in baseball that I do think are worth acknowledging. I mean, the A's are their own story. The Reds are the one that really hits me. I mean, they did win in 1990, so there are definitely a lot of fans of the Reds. I know for a fact, because my father-in-law is one of them, that remembers the Reds winning, and like that's not something that is this distant. I can't even, it's hazy. But the Reds have the longest drought of not winning a postseason series. Haven't won since 1995.
Sure.
That is terrible.
And I think there's a strong argument that Reds fans have had the worst time.
Recently.
Like, they might not have the longest drought, but it's probably the least enjoyable franchise to have rooted for over the last three plus decades. However, we're gonna cut it off at the Mets at 86. So no Twins in 91, Blue Jays in 93. Yes, we have the Rays have never won. They started in 98.
Yeah,
Rays, the Rockies
Rays and
have
Rockies.
Never won in 93. So like, we're just going to crumple all that up, put it to the side, and we're going to focus on this octet of Cleveland, Milwaukee, San Diego, Seattle, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Detroit, Queens and Seattle. Jordan, what touches your fancy here? Like, what is of these droughts? Let's start in Cleveland, where you are.
Yeah.
Because I think the Guardians drought is 21 years longer than the second longest drought. And this is the, like, in my mind, this is the baseball drought now. Okay. 1948
absolutely
was a long, I mean, that was a couple of years ago. I think Justin Verlander only had one Cy Young at that point.
Correct.
Back in 1948. And that the Cleveland Cavaliers won does change the tenor of this. That the LeBron Cavs got a ring makes the Guardians drought slightly less notable on like a national stage. Because if not for that, I mean, we're talking a city with nothing, right? We're talking no Cavs, no Browns, no Guardians since 48. Then I think it is still elevated at a different level. That's not to say that Guardians fans have not suffered and waited. I'm saying I think both the time gap between the Guardians and then what was Cubs, Red Sox, White Sox, and the LeBron, you know, chase down block pushes this to a slightly lower tier for now.
100%. I still think it because of its length, and it's still we're going to talk about these eight. Maybe we'll rank them, draft them, whatever. The point I want to make, and as someone who's now lived in this area for not more than just 2 years, went to college up here, and I expect to be here. So this is certainly a drought I've thought about. I thought about it when they got to the CS a couple years ago, and as an organization that I expect to keep winning, I mean, this is something that I think about for sure. Even as someone who didn't grow up a fan of the team, this is certainly something I'd be like, oh my God, am I going to ever cover this? And the two points I want to make, though, that give this drought heft, in addition to the obvious sheer size of it and length, but also slightly less so. One is just 2016, right? For that, World Series to have happened and to get that close and then to still lose, right? To have the Rajai Davis moment and then to still lose, that adds a level that still permeates throughout any conversation about the organization over the last 10 years, especially because so many of those people are still in charge, right? Sure, maybe it's just Jose Ramirez that's around as a player, but because there's been so much continuity at the front office level, I think that's all relevant. The point that I just want to make for sure, and this is, I guess, sort of relevant to the Knicks as well. Yes, the fact that the Cavs won makes it slightly less so, but here's the other thing. This is a Browns town. And it's not that there aren't diehard baseball fans that are going to go nuts if and when they win. The Browns drought, which is almost as long, right? I mean, they haven't won in, really never won an NFL franchise. They left, they came back. It's the Browns. That's what people want to talk about is the Browns. And the Browns have been more woeful. They've been way less competent. The premise of the Browns winning is so much more absurd. Like, that's more along the lines of the Knicks or the Jets or something like that. So I think the Browns winning would be not infinitely crazier. It would be crazier. However, let's not totally discount what the Guardians have. So I do want to make sure I caveat that.
I do think that if we're talking what championship remaining would lead in American professional sports would lead to the wildest parade, like would lead to
Browns the, in the mix.
Craziest scenes. Yep. I think it's Browns Bills in their own category together. Browns Bills as honorary Buffalonians. I think we cannot discount the Bills in that conversation. Let's move on to the Brewers, who have not just never won since being conceived in 1969, although technically 1970, okay, because of the Seattle Pilots. Just saying. They have not been to a World Series since 1982. This Brewers team over the last recent stretch of time has been very good. Not quite as good as the Dodgers, as we saw in the CS, but pretty darn good. I think an important dynamic here is the Milwaukee Braves, who did win a World Series. So, like, we have seen a World Series in Milwaukee, right? Now, granted, that was, like, in the 50s. You know, that was during the Eisenhower administration. And I think it's not as if that is stuck in the recent memories of many a Milwaukeean. But I think it is just slightly important context here. How do we feel about the Brewers drought.
Yeah, I think them, right, 1957, the Milwaukee Braves win. They also lose the World Series the next year in seven games. So now that's still long enough ago that are there that many Milwaukee anything fans? Those aren't Brewers fans. Yes, the city technically has won a championship. You can find people that remember in New York the Knicks winning. That's not hard to do. That will talk about it. I had the pleasure of talking to Dave Sims, voice of the Yankees, who, of course, was then longtime voice of the Mariners. He's from Philly, but his media career really started in New York in the 70s and the 80s, and he remembers that very well. And I was talking to him about that when the Yankees were in town. Whereas yes, I'm sure there are people that have been in Milwaukee since then that can maybe talk about that, but it's not the same thing. I think the Brewers going this long, and it's a little bit different than Cleveland because they haven't gotten that close, and they certainly not as close as 2016. But this is a very recent thing because we feel like the Brewers have become this model franchise that should get over the top. And I think that what happened last year, this is very fresh, that made it feel like you still have so far to go because of how bad they got beat by the Dodgers has right. added like, to this level of pain and frustration for sure.
The Brewers last year was like hiking to Everest base camp, which is its own preposterous athletic achievement. And then you get there and you look up at the mountain and you're like, oh my God. I think that the drought, the Brewers drought, raises the stakes of the current Brewers operation to me.
Totally.
Because not all good things last forever. You know, this is in some ways a golden era of Brewers baseball.
Yes.
In terms of its sustainability, and it's only going to get more sustainable. Like, they have one of the best farm systems in the sport, ton of talent matriculating up. If they do not win a World Series in the Jackson Churio era,
right,
which right. I understand could be like 20 years, like that could be
right,
that could be a long, long time. Like, if they don't win it in the Matt Arnold, you know, Mizorowski zone, then my worries about that drought kind of level up a little
totally.
Bit.
Totally. Totally. And again, comparing, now, there's a lot of comparisons you can make with them with Cleveland. They also have an NBA championship sure. recently. But I also think that the window, even though Cleveland has a bright future too in a lot of respects, we're talking about Jose Ramirez. We're talking about, I guess you could throw Christian Yelich in for the Brewers, but it's sure. a very different conversation in terms of like winning now, it while X is here.
What's interesting about that town is that it is a Packers town, though the Packers don't play there. And right. so if you're doing Bucks versus Brewers, it is Brewers over Bucks. And that's not particularly sure. close in my mind, having yep. spent time yep. there. But the Packers make the dynamic a little bit more interesting. Now, Jordan, you are currently wearing a Walla Walla Padres hat. And I think the reason you are wearing a Walla Walla Padres hat is that you are going to make the argument for the San Diego Padres drought being the most painful, or the most interesting, the most notorious, and the one that you are the most compelled by. So I'm going to kick the rock to you because I do agree in some ways. I do think the Padres have a real argument here as the only tenant left in the building.
Yeah, I am wearing this hat to throw some amount of support behind San Diego. I'm not sure I can say that they are the objective answer. I also just love this hat and would wear it every episode if I didn't want to commit to being more diverse with my hat selection. That said, I think what San Diego has is very simple, and it's that they haven't won anything. There's no, it hasn't happened for any sport, and they've only had so many sports, professional sports teams over the years. And now the Padres are the only ones left. And like Milwaukee, they've never won in the entirety of their existence. And now just knowing, especially just the teams that have left, and now what the Padres kind of mean to this town and what that fan base has gone through in terms of irrelevance for a lot of part of the 21st century. And then now this resurgence, but then also this very tenuous, chaotic experience of being a Padres fan over the last 10 years because of AJ Preller and, of course, the ownership that empowered him. Now we have an ownership change as well that adds another layer to the story, for better or for worse. And so it's just a unique thing. I think you mentioned Buffalo, of course, with the Sabres and the Bills. There are some other cities that have had longer droughts. I think Minnesota is also an interesting one here because they have multiple teams and have not won anything in over three decades. So that's a, even it's not as long. We're just talking about the city and the totality of it. But the Padres in San Diego at large is just, I mean, it's a very unique one in this conversation. And especially as people who always want to think baseball first, the fact that this is this city where baseball is really the only thing left with respect to some of the other smaller teams that maybe still exist there at a professional level, it's unique. It's unique. And it makes me really think about those fans in a very specific way.
Yeah, we're not trying to throw shade to San Diego FC or San Diego Wave FC. I'm glad they were, you know, creative with those names. This is the Padres show now, and they are packing the place on a regular basis. What I find so interesting is that there's this clear delineation in Padres history between a couple of hardos caring about this and then the whole city suddenly caring about this. And I think that the pain amplifying in that way, where it's like, yeah, we have hope now, but baseball is this inherently soul-crushing endeavor. Come aboard. We'd love to have you.
This is your best chance at glory is the sport that is just a 6-month pain train. It's like, or hop 8 months, I guess. Yeah, come along.
Hop on.
And yeah, same thing with the Brewers and I guess the Guardians and maybe the Mariners, the conversation that we're going to have. You feel like you have this opportunity, this golden era where you've been winning a bunch. And so it's different than a Browns or a team that's completely hopeless. And then you can't even envision them being in the postseason, let alone winning at all. The Padres have actually gotten pretty close. Obviously, this year it's a little bit different, but still a good ball club. Speaking of good ball club, Seattle.
You know what feeling good feels like. Yes. And yet you can't touch the ultimate good feeling. Seattle Mariners time. So the Seahawks just won. They have won. You would know better than I whether this is a Seahawks, a Mariners, a Kraken, or even a Sonics town. Maybe the only town where I would throw the MLS team in, you know, I don't think it's the answer, but I throw the Sounders into the mix. Mariners have never won. They have existed since 1977. And Mariners fandom has been, is the Mariners are their own funky, wonky story that John Boyce covered so thoroughly in his brilliant work. Jordan, I'll just let you talk on this, considering you're someone that cares deeply about the Seattle Mariners.
Yeah, I mean, this one's not that complicated. They're the only team it's never been. So to be the last team left that has not actually been to the World Series is, I mean, that's tough to really replicate. Yes, the fact that the Seahawks have been quite successful. I guess the Sonics did win an NBA championship in the 70s, so there are probably some local sports fans that have that memory. But this is the one thing that the Mariners have over everybody else, and boy, did they come close last season to ending that fun fact. So I do think that while they are not alone because of Milwaukee and San Diego as teams that have never won, in Colorado and Tampa Bay, having not even experienced winning a pennant, knowing, oh my God, I get to watch my team as one of the last two teams, I still think that puts them up there above or with any other drought that you have. And I think it really is that simple. With all the other cursed history of this team and franchise, you could go into that, but I just think it is that simple if we are comparing droughts here, that is something that they have that no one else does.
The Pirates drought, they have not won since 1979. And the Orioles drought can kind of be linked together in my mind. Sure. And that's not just because those teams were playing in that World Series. These were two of the most dominant operations for a 20-year stretch in baseball history. Like 60s, 70s, and 80s, early 80s. Like it's Pirates and Orioles. It's Reds, it's A's. But like, Pirates and Orioles are like the centers of the sport in a lot of ways, which sounds preposterous from where we sit today, where these two franchises, while entertaining and have these large fan bases, because of the way that the sport has moved, they don't feel like these fulcrums anymore. They don't feel like a core of it in that same fashion. There is also the dynamic that these two franchises have dealt with the pain and the frustration of ownership incompetence. The Orioles have maybe moved past that into the David Rubenstein era. The Pirates are definitely still in that. Jordan, one day they will have post-nutting clarity, and I hope that moment comes soon for the Pittsburgh Pirates when Bob Nutting, their owner, kind of lets go of the reins. But for now, I think you can group these two teams together.
Yeah, and this is another one where the larger sports landscape of the city is relevant. In some ways, I think it strengthens the Pirates' case because of how successful the Penguins and the Steelers have been, that they've been able to see their teams, their black and yellow teams, be champions multiple times, I believe. And they're Pirates, they're woeful Pirates. I just mentioned, what's the thing that the Mariners fans can say? Well, we have been waiting X, you know, years to even see. They haven't even gotten there. The Pirates have the longest active drought without reaching the CS. They haven't even been to the championship series since 1992. Okay, so they haven't even got, like, right, we saw the Mariners were however many outs away last year. The Pirates haven't even gotten remotely close. We know they have the longest postseason drought in the National League. And so it's just a different conversation. The Orioles have been a little bit more turbulent up and down. Oh my God, we win 100 games. Oh my God, we lose 100 games. Now we're stuck in the middle. The Orioles, also Baltimore, have had the Ravens, we should say. That's not insignificant that they've had the Ravens.
I do think that it is a Ravens town now. I think that is the consequence of what the Orioles have been over the last 25 years, that by not being consistent, but they lost relevance in the city and got surpassed. Part of that is just a conversation about football and baseball and how they interact in modern American society. But that is what happens when you don't compete on a regular basis. Like, okay, the St. Louis Rams, there's a number of reasons the St. Louis Rams had to move to LA. Right. But the Cardinals never being bad, making that a baseball town, is certainly a part of that story. I think if you are consistently in the mix, you are forcing your fans to believe every year you have a chance. The Orioles have had these stretches where it's just not even close. And I think the Pirates are the same way in that regard, right? Where it's like, I'm waking up on opening day and like, I have this. Everyone believes when the season, like, no, like, that's not true. And you see that in the interest and you see that in the ticket sales. The Pirates are at this point now where that interest is bubbling back up. The Orioles are in this weirder spot. They're like 2 years ahead of the Pirates, right? They make the playoffs in 23. They make the playoffs in 24. They don't win a playoff game in either of those seasons. And now you have the fan base thinking, like, is this real? Is this worth caring about? And when you go to Camden Yards and you look up at the left field seats and you see a sea of no one sitting there, right? That is kind of a concern that I have. So two left, Tigers and the Mets, 1984 and 1986. Now, obviously, the Mets get a little bit more sauce here because they're the Mets. And their failures have more of a Yakety Sax aura to them.
Yeah, but hey, I mean, I just listened to Sean Fennessy on Zach Lowe's podcast, and he sounds like a changed man. He sounds like someone who's going to have a lot more patience for the Mets because the Knicks just won. So I know that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's hard to ignore that as part of the factor here. I think in some respects, it's going to make the Mets' ineptitude with the $400 million payroll even worse, because it's like, if the Knicks can figure their stuff out, I know it's a different league, whatever. Why can't we? And yet here they are still. I know you just won a series against the Braves. In some ways, it'll make it more frustrating now that you've seen the Knicks can do it, because for so long, I'm sure fans of both of those teams have been like, well, neither of these teams are ever going to figure it out. I'm just doomed to blue and orange hell forever. But no, I think now the Mets can at least look at the Knicks and either see hope or see it as like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing that the Mets are still are where they are. I have Detroit thoughts as well, but give me what you take on the Mets.
The Mets have bought themselves some time this season. I really do think the Mets owe a great deal both to the Red Sox and the Knicks this season, just by shielding them from fury, shielding them from relative amounts of criticism. The Jets probably belong on that list as well. I think that to be a Knicks and Mets fan, I would like to hear from those people. If you are Mets and then Knicks, right? If like your first love is the Mets and your mistress is the Knicks, do you wake up on this Monday morning and feel more hope about the Mets? Or do you wake up on this Monday morning and feel less hopeful about the Mets? I think it could go either way. Let's finish up with the Tigers here. We've not won since 1984. It's a long time. It's a couple years to wait. I mentioned this earlier. That was Justin Verlander's rookie season, 1984. He's been around that long. How do you contextualize the Tigers' drought?
So the things that come to mind with Detroit are, one, that they had that run where I know they get swept in the World Series, but you know, at the start of the 2010s, to go to three straight CSs and have these incredible Hall of Fame talents right there, because you got swept in the World Series, it doesn't feel like you got quite as close. That said, to then fall into this very dark period of rebuilding and losing 114 games in 2019. And then now we've talked plenty about the Tigers to seemingly have a resurgence, get back to the postseason for two straight years. And then now you have this critical season that has gone haywire. A lot going on there. And then, but the other thing to think about with Detroit is again, the larger sports landscape. You have, like Cleveland, a football analog with the Lions, who also just has this tortured history and has not won anything in decades and decades and decades and decades. The Pistons have won. The Red Wings have won. But that has been a while for those two teams. And I'm pretty sure the Red Wings are also. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that at a certain point, people called Detroit title town, hockey town, hockey town. Well, they called it hockey town.
Like, yeah, I mean,
they were the center of the hockey world for like a stretch of time.
For sure. Yeah. Exactly. 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 So the Red Wings had that. They have not had that recently. The Pistons have also been very bad. I know they were good this year, but they haven't won in a long time. Still, it's teams that are remembered. But as far as the city goes, I know, you know, 1984 is not as long ago as the 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s, but I don't know. This is a still pretty compelling one. Like, I'd still put this over Baltimore, all things considered, with the combination, because they don't have another team that's been good recently. Yeah. But yeah, I was going to say, just to wrap up this conversation, like, this is also so unfair. There are fans of these teams that are like, no, I'm suffering the most. And we cannot speak for everybody. And we cannot speak for all these other sports and all these cities. We're just doing our best with our baseball perspective as two guys that were born in 1995. But yeah, if you were to rank these in any way, how would you do it, do you think?
Well, you're ranking them with what prompt, right? Like, am I ranking them by the biggest sufferers? Am I ranking them by the most lit parade at the end of it? If I'm going pain, I think Cleveland does need to be at one, because it is 20 years longer, because the only people that remember the joy are grandparents now. Right. And when those memories, one sad thing about grandparents is that their memories fade. And I think, as it is said, we lose our recipes. And I think as fewer and fewer people exist that remember Cleveland lifting up the trophy, that was a definitively different era. I mean, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier like before. Yeah. Like, this is not. Think about it this way, right? When you go to Baseball Reference and you do a StatHead search, you will often just do integration era or expansion era, right? That's the era. That's the whole era, effectively, is modern baseball. We think about it since integration. Well, so there's an argument that the Guardians have barely won in modern baseball history, and very few people remember it. So in my mind, I go Guardians 1. I would go Padres 2 because they're the only show in town. I would go Mariners 3 because they haven't even been to the show, haven't even seen a World Series. I would then go Brewers 4. I would go Pirates 5. Mets 6, Tigers 7, Orioles 8, which I know as someone that grew up an Orioles fan is sort of sacrilege, and I will get a phone call from my mother about this. But that is how I would rank them.
Yeah, and I think I like your order. I think I'd put Pittsburgh over Milwaukee. Even with their other teams winning, sure. I think they've been so woeful in the last few decades that's a tough one. It's also – the last thing I'll say about that, just because you mentioned like grandparents remembering Cleveland, it is a weird dynamic to then have folks like that, or even in Pittsburgh, same thing, that remember those versus nothing to remember. Right? So was it more sad that there are people that there are some people that remember that have these glimmers of, oh yeah, they won it and this, and versus there's no, if you've been a Brewers fan the whole time, there's nothing even to look back on. It's like, okay, yeah, this is just what it is. Like, you just don't win the World Series.
Our parents were born in the early 1960s, right? And like, if they were born in San Diego or Milwaukee, they would get if you're born in 1960, the Brewers or the Padres showing up to your town is like a seminal moment of your childhood. And like, all you can remember is that fandom your entire life. And you've never touched it. You've never tasted it. You don't know what that ultimate feeling is. And there is something really tragic to that. I just think that what happens with something like the Guardians is those memories do get passed down. And it creates this want my old granny to reach the mountaintop again before the clock runs out. You know what I mean? And to me, that is like this more dire sense of droughtness that puts Cleveland at one for me.
In conclusion, go Sabres. We're going to take a break. When we return, we recap the weekend that was in Major League Baseball. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I mean, we're like 35 minutes in here and we haven't talked about a baseball game over the weekend. Let's do that and go around the league. The best pitching performance of the year happened over the weekend. Jacob Mizorowski, that gangly, flailing collection of limbs, that Pokemon card collecting, flame throwing, fire breathing MF'er for the Milwaukee Brewers, faced the minimum on Friday evening, punching out 15, didn't walk a soul, threw the three fastest pitches by a starter in the StatCast era, 104.5, 104.1, 103.5, absolutely pounded the zone all night long, and he didn't even have to face Paraguay. Did it against the Philadelphia Phillies. The context here is funny. Miz was negged into oblivion around a year ago when he made the All-Star team ahead of Christopher Sanchez. He did face the Phillies last year afterwards and got knocked around a little bit. But on 1 year to the day of his MLB debut, he solidified himself as the best pitcher on the planet.
I mean, that's what that looked like. I think when we've been talking about Mizorowski this season, he has looked like the pitcher that is the most difficult to score against. More than Ohtani, more than Christopher Sanchez, more than Paul Skeens, more than Cam Schlittler, more than all the great injured pitchers that aren't pitching right now. He has when you are watching Jacob Mizorowski, he is the one that is most making you think, how in the world is anybody going to score a run?
It's inconceivable that Don Mattingly and the Phillies coaching staff and Major League Baseball and Rob Manfred and God would have the audacity to ask Trey Turner and Gabriel Rincones and co. to stand in there and get knocks off of this unicorn. That is a ridiculous ask. That's like, hey, Jordan, can you run a 330 mile for me right now? No, you can't do that. That is what hitting Jacob Mizorowski is like at this current point in time. Because at the end of the day, hitting a baseball or attempting to prevent someone else from hitting a baseball is just a math problem. It is, you have this amount of time from the time the ball leaves my hand to the time the ball passes you to hit this ball. The harder you throw the ball, the less time someone has. Jacob Mizrowski is throwing so freaking hard that he has changed the equation. He has tilted the scales. He has ruined the accepted distances of the game, right? Like 60 feet, 6 inches feels wrong. It feels too small. It feels like the kid in the Little League World Series who looks 15 and has a mustache blowing it by, you know, little Timmy from rural South Dakota. That's what Jacob Mizrowski feels like to me.
Yeah, it's we've mentioned it, but to be throwing harder than we've ever seen and then also have a lead extension, he is getting so far down the mound and then throwing that hard. I talked to a couple of the Yankees about having just faced Miz, and they were just like, yeah, I've never seen anything like that before. And they did a little bit better than the Phillies. The lone base runner comes courtesy of Kyle Schwarber with a leadoff single in the top of the fourth on a first pitch 91-mile-per-hour slider low in the zone. Well done, Kyle Schwarber. This was exactly the right approach because you could tell when you would want. Now, in some cases, some of these hitters had no chance regardless of the count and regardless of the pitches, whatever. He's going up there and be like, you know what I'm not going to do is wait for him to gas me up at 103. So as soon as he saw something remotely slow, which in this case, a 91-mile-an-hour slider, he smashes it up the middle. But that was immediately erased by a Bryce Harper double play a couple batters later. That is why he faced the minimum, as he did not hit anyone, did not walk anybody. But I do think that when you were – and I was watching most of this live. Once Schwarber got that, I was like, okay, well, no one else is going to get a hit. I mean, this is – just because Schwarber did, he's going to go. I did not think he was going to finish this game. Yeah. Even when he finished the eighth, I didn't think he was going to finish the game because they were up six. And I figured, you know what? They're just going to keep being conservative. He had never even pitched in the eighth inning, let alone the ninth. And yet they let him go get it. And part of it was because he was being, especially by Miz standards, and this has been true this season. He's been throwing more strikes than ever. That's part of why his numbers are so ridiculous. But he was just more efficient than we've ever seen. He threw like 20 balls the whole game. I mean, he threw maybe eight through the first five innings. And so they went out and let him go get it. And he finishes it in under 100 pitches.
It was the Maddux.
Yeah, it's one of the best pitching performances of all time.
Right? A Greg Maddux, a complete game under 100. Calling this a Maddux is so funny. Because not in Greg Maddux's wildest dreams could he have conceived of Jacob Mizrowski. Right? Greg Maddux, who made his name and his legend by nibbling on the edge with mid to low 90s junk and a quite large kitchen sink, Jacob Mizrowski is blowing it past you. And that has been the biggest difference this year with him, is this understanding that his stuff plays in the zone, right? Mm-hmm. People are going to knock him. They'll get the bat around to a bad cutter, a bad slider, a hanging curveball, and they'll hit one every once in a while. Not recently, but they will. It's how many guys do you have on base when that happens? And because he is throwing more in the zone, he's being more aggressive, he's attacking, he doesn't have walks. Like, he's not walking guys in the same way. And that is an approach thing. Now, his command, as we'll compare him to Yoshinobu Yamamoto in a second, his command is good. It is not great. It is good enough. There's the difference between control and command, right? Is command is you're putting it where you want. Control is you're putting it in the strike zone. Like, he threw so many pitches just like down the pipe, just center cut. But because it's coming out at 103, it doesn't matter. One of my favorite moments of this game was Justin Crawford, I believe in his first or second at bat, 1-0 count against Jacob Mizrowski, right? A time to swing, to get the foot down. You know you're getting a heater. Justin Crawford, a lefty facing a righty, check swings on a 1-0 center cut fastball for a called strike, right? Like, I mean, that is nuts. And that's what people always say, how do you know how nasty a pitcher is? Watch the swings. Watch the hitters. These are the best in the world at what they do. And for Mizrowski, the Phillies are just guessing and they're missing the ball by just a ridiculous amount.
Trey Turner had zero chance. I mean, he probably of everybody in the lineup looked the most hopeless. He looked like the one with the least amount of plan, which is also just sometimes true of Trey Turner. Is he just kind of going up there and swinging and trusting he's going to be able to be a superior athlete. And when your stuff is that good, you're not going to be as, or when their stuff is that good, sorry, you have no chance. I would say him, Rincones, poor Gabriel Rincones, Phillies outfield prospect, make his major league debut. Tough assignment. And then, yeah, Justin Crawford truly looked overmatched to a truly comical degree. Shout out to Alec Bohm, who was the only Philly that did not strike out in this game. So amidst a pretty forgettable, disappointing season, that is worth something.
Lock him
that
up.
He managed to not strike out in all three of his trips to the plate. But yeah, it was as dominant as a performance that we've ever seen. And it's we say, okay, it's not just the command was. I mean, the dude was walking five guys per nine in junior college. The guy was walking six guys per nine in double A. You know, like this is an enormous step forward in terms of just an ability to be in the zone, let alone spot up perfectly, as we'll talk about some other pitchers. But with when your stuff's this good, man, just throw it sort of near the box and you're going to be in good shape.
Something to keep an eye on. Okay. I believe that the San Diego Padres have not faced. Oh, no, they did. I apologize. Manny Machado has already faced Jacob Mizorowski. With Machado and his comments about the game done be changing on me.
Like, that's what he's talking about.
He did not strike out against him, though. But I would imagine he'd probably strike out against this version of Mizorowski. The Padres and the Brewers face off again on Monday, August 10th. So get your front foot down now, Manny, or else you're cooked. Christopher Sanchez should still start the All-Star game in Philly at home, I believe. Jacob Mizorowski is now making that a conversation. We will pick that up as the Midsummer Classic inches ever closer. Two more important pitching performances to discuss. Yoshinobu Yamamoto on Saturday. Perfect through 7 2/3 innings. And when we say that a pitcher is perfect, this was about as perfect pitcher can be. First batter of the game, okay? He just dots like 96 on the black, four-seam fastball. Next pitch, 91 splitter on the edge, right off that pitch. And it's like, no one on the planet is able to do what they want more often than Yoshinobu Yamamoto.
Yeah, I mean, this is why he's become one of my favorite pitchers ever, frankly. I just watching this guy do his job is just a treat. And he's really started to lock it in. On May 12th, he allowed 5 runs against the Giants. That brought his ERA to...
Wow, hard to do.
Right, 3 homers in that game. That brought his ERA to 3.60. And at that point, he was so far off of this amazing NL Cy Young conversation that Mizorowski and Sanchez and Skeens and Braxton Ashcraft have been at the top of. Chase Burns, shout out.
Sure.
5 starts since then, Yamamoto has a 1.01 ERA. He has allowed 4 runs in 35 2/3 innings, 32 strikeouts, 5 walks, 17 hits allowed. And I was not watching this game on Saturday, but how this perfect game effort ended, well, first the perfect game ends, and then the no-hitter ends, were what was more shocking? I'm not sure what was more statistically improbable. I know Tristan Peters is having a nice season.
Okay, so in the bottom of the eighth.
But tell me what happened, because you were watching
this. In the bottom of the eighth, with 2 down, Chase Mydroth, Chicago White Sox,
my man,
Nubs 1, 2 shortstop, a routine ground ball, not a tough play. Maybe it had a little bit of English or even some Scottish on it. Mookie Betts, sure-handed as it gets, future Hall of Famer, boots it, puss in boots it. Ball pops up into the air. Santiago Espinal tries to barehand it. Mydroth scampers down the line. Perfect game. Over. Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Overrated. Mookie Betts clearly felt very bad about this in the dugout. He was like a little everything Mookie does is so cool all the time. He was like a little flustered. He was like very animated in the dugout. You know, everyone makes mistakes, man. Everyone has those days. But it was shocking to see this, especially after Mookie had made a play on a grounder, like literally the batter before, that looked very similar to this. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, good thing it's going to Mookie, right? That's the guy who you like, you want the ball in his hands,
right?
Right. Jalen Brunson style. Game 7 of the World Series ends with Mookie Betts turning a beautiful double play. Right. And so for it to end that way was definitely unforeseen. Out comes Yamamoto for the ninth to finish the no hitter with the perfect game gone. And Tristan Peters, a man that was literally once a Savannah banana, turns one around, leads off the inning with a solo shot. Perfect game gone, shutout gone, no hitter gone, all of it gone, the game gone. The game is gone, thanks to Tristan Peters. Really, the game is gone thanks to the Savannah Bananas, but that's a different conversation. Yamamoto, incredible performance. The only pitcher in MLB history to retire the last 22 batters of one outing and the first 22 of his next outing. That's from OptiStats. Really good nugget there. Now, despite this dominance, you know, we could wax poetic about Yamamoto for ages. This was a weekend for the White Sox. Southsiders have the big boy Dodgers rolling into town, and they take 2 out of 3 in invigorating fashion with wins on Friday and Sunday. There is something real happening on the South Side, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of previewed it on Friday. This opportunity to continue to show that you are a good baseball team. And I feel like they didn't sweep, but not getting perfect games and then winning the other two games is about as good Now, I will also mention, as I said on Friday, it did not hurt that Shohei Ohtani did miss one game, and not having Ohtani in the lineup is, as we saw, because he immediately homered on Saturday, is significant. Yeah. He did miss one game on Friday, you know, kind of nursing
he picked up a knock.
That knee injury. Yes, yes.
As they say in footy, picked up a knock.
Okay.
Now, I would like to tell a little story here.
Yeah. Yep.
Sorry, I'm watching a lot of World Cup, guys. I am grinding tape. You know, I'm up at midnight for the Socceroos. I'd like to tell a little story here about why I think the vibes around the White Sox have genuinely changed. So Andrew Benintendi, I think, has been the symbol of pointlessness, of aimlessness, of drab vibe for the White Sox over the last few seasons. Is that fair? Benintendi signed to this 5-year, $75 million free agent contract, the largest free agent contract in franchise history, kind of the last surviving member of an era when the White Sox were trying to be good with Tim Anderson and Giolito and Jose Abreu, right? Like that old time. And he's only on the team as they're bad because, like, they're paying him, you know? And he's a bummer. Andrew Benintendi, he's not, like, a bad guy. He is the, in my mind, like, the prototype of vet. Like, straight-laced, sure. Like, shaved before coming to the Yankees. Like, I'm sure the second he saw there were, like, rumors he might be traded to the Yankees, he shaved. Like, he was amped about that. Like, he's that kind of type of character. Hold that in your head. Okay, Sam Antonacci represents the new White Sox, this fiery, this high energy, this, you know, spark of life that has arrived for the Pale Hose. And there was a cool story about how Antonacci has had like a strip of tape on his helmet that he has worn in college. He wore in the minors, like on the hole where the helmet ear is. He like had a little tape around the edge. And when he got to the big leagues, he stopped doing that because he was afraid that it didn't look show. This was tweeted from Brooke Fletcher, the sideline reporter for the White Sox. It started when he was in JUCO as a superstition, and he's had that little bit of tape at every level. Stopped doing it because he didn't want to look kind of janky because he thought it made the helmet look broken. He got more comfortable in the big leagues, and he brought it back. And then in mid-May, who adopted the helmet tape, Jordan? But Andrew Benintendi. And since doing that helmet tape dumb little thing on his ear, Benintendi's numbers have gotten a whole lot better. And to me, this story, as convoluted as it is, kind of exemplifies that there is something different happening. That even Andrew Benintendi, who I would describe as like unk, as an old head, as more of an old school, old era player, is embracing this new energy that the White Sox have brought in. And I find that to be very invigorating and very representative of what is happening there.
Yeah, what a strange career for Andrew Benintendi, but it is cool that he has been just competent enough to not be jettisoned. And we'll see if that's still true through the duration of his contract, still under contract for another year next year. But it is, I'm happy for him because, my God, for him to show up as this marquee signing and for them to immediately start losing at a historic pace is pretty tough. It's pretty tough. Not to his fault, but he was certainly attached to all that losing. And now he gets to do some winning with the first place Chicago White Sox. One other note about this series is that Roky was bad on Friday. Oops. We got really excited about what he looked like against the Angels.
Should have worn the pride hat.
That's true. That's true. But that said, that's another 7 runs. So credit to the White Sox, who clearly are a lineup that can hit. And it doesn't take away what Roky looked like against the Angels. But it's just another be like, okay, we said it. You got to show it against good teams. White Sox are a good team. And he was not able to do that. So we will continue to monitor Mr. Sasaki moving forward.
Let's do Tarek Skubal, and then we'll take a break. Tarek Skubal pitched over the weekend, everybody. That in and of itself is a remarkable reality. Underwent elbow surgery on May 6th, getting the nanoscope, tiny little prick in his elbow, whatever you want to call it. Because the incision was smaller than it usually is, his recovery was able to be faster, less scar tissue, less recovery needed. And 38 days after being on the operating table, Tarek Skubal took the mound. And he was good. If you just look at the final line, 4 2/3, 5 hits, 3 runs, 2 earned, 1 walk, 4 Ks, 80 pitches, you're like, that's not Tarek Skubal. The stuff was there, man. Now, the command was fine. It wasn't Skubal-y. I would say that the slider didn't look perfect in the way that it usually does. The changeup was very good and not elite. He really made one bad pitch, missed his spot on an 0-2 fastball to Daniel Schneemann, was trying to go up and away. It kind of leaked back over the plate. Schneemann improbably hit it out to right field, becoming just the fourth left-handed hitter to take Skubal deep since Tarek Skubal became Tarek Skubal at the start of 2024. Only 4 lefties have gone yard off Skubal over that time. And so I think that was more like God shining down upon Daniel Schneemann in that moment. But Skubal's velo was there. I mean, it was 98. He was pumping. Kind of a classic AJ Hinch, Tigers manager move, telling reporters that there's no governor on Skubal and then removing him at exactly 80 pitches. Can't say I'm surprised. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed to be reaching out of the line. So I was not in the building in Cleveland for this, but I know you watched this closely. The Schneemann thing is nuts. I mean, the fact you just gave is a good way to encapsulate it. The other two points I would make, that's one of them. And the other one is that he's been the worst hitter in baseball since May 1st. He had a really nice start to his season and has seemed to be developing into a nice role player for Cleveland, but he has not hit at all recently. So for him to have that big swing that ended up, being the difference in a close 3-1 game. And while I agree with you, it's encouraging that Skubal generally looked like Skubal. He was throwing hard. The stuff looked pretty good. It'll just be the thing I just keep saying about the Tigers. They need to win. You can't afford these games. Like, you can't, you have to start making up some ground and to lose 2 more games against Cleveland. Now 0-6 against Cleveland this year. Sunday gets rained out. It was very sunny for when they called it, but it did end up raining later that day. The point is now you're still 9.5 back. You're 29-42. And any amount of feeling like, all right, Skubal's back, now we go, that's fine. He's still going to only pitch once a week. They might be moving to like a six-man rotation. He's just not going to be that relevant in terms of helping the Tigers win as they try and dig their way out of this hole. And it's just a huge hole.
It's a huge hole. And with all due respect to the Tigers fans who we talked about on the first segment and your long, long drought, what happened on Saturday was the best possible scenario for Skubal the trade chip. I think we got a report from Bob Nightingale that the Tigers aren't going to like make a real decision on Skubal till after the All-Star break. That's understandable. That's not surprising. They have all the time in the world until the deadline, right, in early August. But if you, what is the most interesting outcome this season for Tarek Skubal, for like us as neutrals? It's him getting traded to a contender, right? And seeing what the size of that package is and him like being a mercenary somewhere. Like the best case scenario is like the Brewers trade for him, right? And he does like CC Sabathia type vibes. The Tigers losing and him throwing 98 is like the way that that happens, you know? Now, I don't wish pain upon Tigers fans. We're just looking at math. I mean, they're 9.5 out now.
Yep.
Like they're 12 games under 500. Yeah. Like they are 13 games under 500. They're 6 out of a wild card spot. Like, that is not it, man.
I am excited to talk about Tarek Skubal to the Brewers trades, but I am going to take the under on 7 complete games that CC Sabathia threw.
That's fair.
Maybe. I don't know if Boris is going to want him out there chucking 100 and however many pitches Sabathia was going regularly down the stretch then.
I will ask you this multiple times over the next couple of weeks. I think now is a fair time to kind of start this conversation now that Skubal's back. Does Tarek Skubal get traded?
Yes. I'm leaning yes.
I think so too.
I'm not all the way
there. I'm leaning yes. If you want to think about this like a meter, right, that is going to kind of oscillate between yes and no, I think right now we're looking at yes. Now that could change if the Tigers get hot or his elbow starts barking again. But I think, yeah, I think he gets traded.
Quickly on Cleveland, Jose Ramirez has a broken hamate. Uh-oh, don't love that. He's obviously quite important. He also has not been on the injured list since 2019. So he has just been
That's
a constant
amazing.
Presence. Yeah. I mean, that for someone that is head first sliding that often,
he has
to never have
not been on the IL as a Cleveland Guardian.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's another way to put it. Yes. But it goes back even longer than that. It's multiple seasons with the previous name. But the point is, yeah, this sucks. We've been now sorry to Vinny Pasquantino. His hamate injury was upstaged by Jose Ramirez. But yeah, I mean, this sucks. We just don't know what it's like to watch this team without Jose for a prolonged period. It's been a long time. They do have now a lot of depth of young, interesting position players that make it feel slightly less dire. But even with Jose's offensive numbers being slightly down this year, you cannot overlook just what he means to the lineup, let alone the other side of the ball, just how other managers have to think about dealing with Jose Ramirez. Now you don't for at least a month, and that's a big deal. So Cleveland has the talent to tread water here, but this is and I'm not exactly sure who's going to fill in Gabriel Arias. They have some other prospects they can make it work. We'll see how it shakes out. I'm sure I'll be writing about that in the coming weeks, but yeah, that sucks.
The last time that Jose Ramirez went on the IL, here was the Cleveland lineup the following day.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
this is August 25th, 2019 against the Royals. Lindor, Oscar Mercado, Carlos Santana, Yasiel Puig, Franmil Reyes, Jason Kipnis, Yu Chang at third base, in for Jose, Kevin Plawecki, Greg Allen, Shane Bieber on the bump. It, in the words of Stained, has been a while. Let's take a break. When we get back, we'll talk about the Tartan Army. We'll talk about the Giants really heartfelt pride night. The Yankees, the Marlins, the Pirates, and everything else around baseball from the week. It's been a long podcast, but it was a busy weekend. Let's go fast. Turbo mode time.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Red Sox taking 2 out of 3 over the Rangers. Their first series win at home since April. First series win at home under new manager Chad Tracy. Couldn't finish the sweep on Sunday Night Baseball. A game that was a highlight of the season as Scotland's Tartan Army, less than 24 hours after their first World Cup win in over 3 decades, on very little sleep and with very much imbibement, marched to Fenway Park, 5,000 strong, bagpipes in tow, kilts on their bottoms, to bring some of the most unique energy we have ever seen at a baseball game. There's a million amazing things about this tournament. Okay? A million amazing things. A Scotland fan, a kid caught a home run ball from Kyle Higashioka on the monster. Okay? But what I loved the most was that they weren't even chanting about the Red Sox, man. They were just in the stands at Fenway for Connolly early against Nady Evaldi, belting chants for their skipper, or their striker, excuse me, John McGinn, who scored the goal against Haiti the day before. What joy.
I'm assuming they were not allowed to bring the bagpipes into the ballpark. And
they were at the World Cup game.
At the World Cup game, okay, but that's very different than at the baseball game. So my experience with bagpipes is very. I went to the College of Worcester, and our mascot was the Fighting Scots, and so bagpipes were a big part of the, you know, football going in for the football game and whatnot. More recently, bagpipes have become relevant because one of my neighbors, who's involved in the local Oberlin Conservatory, is learning how to play bagpipes. Okay? Oh. And I mention that now because my goodness, is it loud. And I love it because it's especially now that I'm watching all these videos on of Scotland playing bagpipes throughout, you know, around Fenway Park. But it is like a storyline in our neighborhood. Is like, when's he going to be practicing the bagpipes? Because it is so loud. If you're seeing videos of it, that's why I asked if it was in the ballpark, because it would be problematic to have this being played during a game. Yes.
The only thing worse than my neighbor plays the bagpipes is my neighbor is learning how to play the bagpipes.
He's good. I love it though. But I can imagine it is a noise that most people.
Yeah.
So like, funny.
Learning like an instrument.
This is not like right here. This is the thing. I know you're seeing some video. This is like, anyway, I love it. I'm all in.
Just quickly, my favorite thing about the. Go. They're my favorite. One of my best friends from college who I just visited in Europe. His girlfriend of a long time is Scottish. I think there's a decent chance that he ends up living in Scotland. He has become honorarily Scottish. And so I have been pulling for the Tartan Army. Jordan, the origins of the Tartan Army and their trademark friendliness are pretty incredible. I was listening to Men in Blazers. They were talking about it. I read some articles about it. So they were hooligans for a long time, the Scots. Like, they were destructive. They were destroying property. Mm. And then in the 80s, as people were trying to clamp down on Scottish-English hooliganism, the Scots basically said, wait a second. We hate what do we hate more than anything in the world? The English. What are the English? Hooligans. Let's be performatively nice when we travel. And so they had, in order to like be the juxtaposition to the English. And that is why the Tartan Army is so kind and so like overtly Scottish. Like, they're performing their Scottishness with the bagpipes and the kilts and whatever. Like, that is to say, we are not English. We are nice. Now, I'm sure the Brits have gotten nicer. The English have gotten nicer as time has gone on, I would hope. But that is the origin of it, which I love, right? It's like the vibe of my enemy is my enemy, you know?
Mm. Yeah, it's too bad that they could not carry the Red Sox to a much needed sweep. Maybe you're not going to get greedy. You'll take a home series win, but man, oh man.
I'm going to bury the Red Sox here. I'm going to bury the Red Sox right here. Because if you can't finish the sweep with this atmosphere, if you can't win this game, you don't have the sauce. You just don't have the sauce. Now, if the Rangers go on to win the World Series, I need the Tartan Army in Arlington. Maybe they'll be there for the final. Or I guess the semifinal, World Cup semifinal in Arlington.
Oh.
But yeah, this was a really delightful moment. Speaking of something that was not a delightful moment, Giants Pride Night.
Well, I think it probably still was.
It was probably still a nice time.
I hope and do believe that there were probably still people that enjoyed this night. However,
you're almost certainly right. You're almost certainly right because Giants Pride Night, the people that were there to enjoy that probably could not see the inflammatory Bible verses inscribed on the hats of the Giants pitchers. They maybe could have seen JT Brubaker's. Did you see how large he wrote his Bible verse? Like, it took up like most of the hat. This has happened before during Pride Nights where players feel a need to kind of take center stage as if they didn't have 161 other games for it to be about them. Three pitchers on the Giants threw Bible verses on their caps for some reason that they then failed to communicate. And that's part of what I have issue with. Sam Henches didn't even wear the Pride cap, which is, the Dodgers did this last week. It's a little bit different, I think, in San Francisco, given the history there. It is, I would say one of the gayest cities in the world. The queer community in San Francisco is so vital to queer history. And they have one of the longest running Pride nights, if not the longest. And so for the players to kind of deprioritize, it was very disappointing. Look, as Landon Rupp said, I'm thankful we live in a country where, we have the freedom to believe what we want and express what we want. That is true. Landon Rupp. Right?
It's Rupp. Pretty sure it's Rupp.
Rupp. Okay. Yeah. I have the freedom to get his name wrong. And
true.
I have the freedom to try and I'm going to criticize him for this. The idea that religion and queerness are incompatible is preposterous. The idea that Christianity and Bible verses and being accepting of LGBT people is incompatible is asinine. To me, that is one of the things that is most disappointing about this. Sam Henches says, it's just something that I feel like I was forced to support when I don't morally support it. There wasn't hatred behind it. I don't hate the LGBTQ community. It's just something that I believed and talked with teammates and family and they supported it. So holding those two things together, there wasn't hatred behind it. I don't hate this community. I don't support it. I need you to explain that further. If you're going to make this stand, those two things don't make sense to me. If you don't support it, but you don't hate them, what is it? Love the sinner, hate the sin? Come on. Let's read a couple books. Cubs took 2 out of 3 over the Giants.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about Spencer Strider in the positive light in this regard on Friday, and part of it is because giving him his flowers in that is the amount that we have players going out of their way to push back as opposed to out of their way to lift up and welcome.
It's not even I have no issue with people flexing or being public about their faith. I think that's a good thing. I talk to players about their faith all the time.
All the time.
But
no one's
stopping
them.
That's not even the thing. They're doing it all the time. But to use Pride Night as the stage to flout your faith, to show your faith, do it on Faith Night. You know what I mean? That is what I think is disappointing and takes away from the positive message that, Logan Webb had some good quotes where he, said he did not support this decision. It is just disappointing. And let's focus on the Spencer Striders of the world, try and lift those people up as much as we're putting down the JT Brubakers and Ryan Walkers of the world. And it's like, if you play in San Francisco, like, just know your history. Know your history. Read your books. I know you have the freedom. I know it's America. You got the freedom to do whatever you want. I have the freedom to critique you. And I'm sure people listening to this will have the freedom to tune me out. Let's move on to the Yankees. We took 2 out of 3 over the Blue Jays. Jose Caballero, what a delightful pest. We had a situation on Sunday where he was not looking at the pitcher. Jose Caballero does this thing where he does not pick his head up to make eye contact with the pitcher until the last millisecond he absolutely has to. It is annoying. It is on brand. It is within the rules. It is using the rules to his advantage. A batter has to make eye contact at the 8-second mark. He does this thing sometimes at 10 seconds where he like taps the plate and like starts to look up and then doesn't look up. And that is what got Blue Jays pitcher Spencer Miles to kind of come set at the wrong time. We had a lot of back and forth between Schneider and Caballero. John Schneider, Blue Jays manager, Caballero. I think the upshot here is that it is just another level of lore piled on to the pestness that is Jose Caballero.
Yeah, I mean, he's been doing this for the entire pitch clock era. This is not new whatsoever.
Still annoying. It is
pissed off certain opponents and umpires more than others. And he's going to keep doing it. I do not expect him to change whatsoever.
No. When the Yankees are going to like win a wild card round or win a round in the playoffs, and Caballero is going to do something super inflammatory and piss someone off and will be one of the biggest characters of our October, I'm calling it. Right now, let's keep moving. Padres, 2 out of 3 over the Orioles. Walker Buehler, really good on Sunday. The Orioles won on Friday, had big homers from Gunnar Henderson and Samuel Basayo. Couldn't really capitalize on that. It's been a very odd season for Gunnar. We had a bizarre storyline between Samuel Basayo and Craig Albernaz, and Basayo being hurt, but not too hurt that he couldn't pinch hit. And then Albernaz said that he was healthy. There's some rumors that this was somehow like punishment for Basayo crossing a line. No one really knows. At the same time, Adley Rutschman was on the IL, so Sam Huff started a couple of games. Upshot there is that Basayo is not like Basayo. Let me pause. The upshot there is that the Orioles are super weird about injuries and have kind of lost the benefit of the doubt of communication in that regard. And so when something like this happens and you say that the guy's okay, but then you don't play him, you're going to just raise questions in the media.
Yeah. And like to have any sort of disconnect, whether it's actual disconnect or it's perceived from the fans with one of your most important players and someone you have signed long term and someone who has actually been good for you this season, just kind of speaks to Baltimore.
Iron it out.
Just come on, clean it up. Good series win for the Walla Walla Padres. Let's go to the Mets and Braves, where the Mets, oh wow, they did it. First time facing the Braves this season, and they're like, you know what? Who cares? We're a million games back. Let's pretend like forget the last 2.5 months. Let's show them that the NL East is gonna be Mets versus Braves, and the Mets do win 2 out of these 3 games. Bo Bichette, okay. Okay, Bo Bichette, maybe yep. Signs of life. Again, he's in quite the hole that he's digging his stats out of, the way that the Mets are in the standings. But nice to see that for him. Strider seems to be hurt. That is a huge bummer, especially seeing that his velo is way down. His elbow is hurting. Yeah. He's already on the injured list again. And now we're back with Strider and Acuna out again, which has unfortunately become very common for the Atlanta Braves.
Must be the wrath of the Lord for him deciding to be an ally. Mets chipping their deficit in the NL East from 15 games to 14 games. Start to feel the heat on your back of your neck, Atlanta Braves. Nats, though, they might be a bigger contender for this division as they take 2 out of 3 at home against the Mariners. The Washington Nationals on June 15th are 37-35. The Seattle Mariners are 37-36. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, I mean, this was this was a classic case where, like, I went on Seattle radio last week. I was like, listen, You ain't just walking into DC and taking dubs.
No.
That's just not how it's going to work. Your pitchers better show up, and they didn't. And the Nationals scored a bunch of runs because that's what they do. So credit to the Nats, who continue to be feisty. And I'm so impressed with them. James Wood should be starting the All-Star game. He's really good. Good news for Seattle, though. Cal Raleigh is coming back. It seems like he's going to be activated this week. He hit a bunch of homers in AAA. I look forward to seeing him back in the lineup.
Jacob Young of the Nats saying, why not us? The reason why not you is because you're probably still going to sell at the deadline. Speaking of teams that will sell at the deadline, the Colorado Rockies rolled into Vegas and scored 23 runs on Sunday, breaking the record for the franchise. Yes, the Colorado Rockies, the goddamn freaking Colorado Rockies, a franchise that has played half their games at the launching pad of Coors Field since 1995. First of 10 of those years was without a humidor. I mean, we're talking moon balls. We're talking Sputnik stuff. They set a franchise record for runs in a game away from home in Las Vegas. An average of 17 runs were scored during the six games that were played at Las Vegas ballpark during the stretch that the A's spent in the Sin City. It is worth noting, as Fuzzy from YouTube points out, the altitude of where they're building the new stadium is 100 feet lower in elevation than where the minor league park is. I did not believe that. I went onto my cycling app and I built a route from the old ballpark to the new ballpark, 992 feet downhill. It's true. And so don't expect the new ballpark to play like this, but still it is kind of an absurd thing that happened.
And it will be inside. Just a note on that franchise record runs scored. The Rockies have scored 17 runs in a game 27 times. How many times was that at Coors Field? Do you want to guess?
15.
No, come on now. 25, 24. That's the whole point. That's exactly what you're getting at. 27 times they've scored 17 runs. 24 of them have been at home.
Wow.
But that new record, 23. Happened at Las Vegas ballpark. Minnesota Twins take 2 out of 3 of the St. Louis Cardinals. Blaze Jordan's in the big leagues. He's interesting. We'll talk about him some other time. St. Louis Cardinals, are you good or not? This was a series that I would expect you to take care of business if you are going to be a relevant contending character in the National League wildcard mix. And it's a couple really ugly losses for St. Louis this weekend.
If you're not good, that's fine. But just let me know. Speaking of teams that I know for sure are not good, thank you to the Anaheim Angels. They did take 2 out of 3 this weekend over the Rays. Couldn't get the sweep done. Jose Siri has been incredible for them. Sure. Mm-hmm. Trey Mancini had a triple, 2 RBI triple.
Nice.
That's all you need to know. Astros, 2 out of 3 over the Royals. Upshot here, Vinny Pasquantino is hurt. Ham 8 bone, 4 to 6 weeks. Royals are going to be in town in the nation's capital this week for UFC Freedom 251. I'll check in. Might be time to bury them. Astros have been better recently. 17 and 13 over the last month. Still in the mix in a bad American League. And let's finish it up. D-backs taking 2 out of 3 over the Reds in Cincinnati. Another great start from Mike Soroka. Mike Soroka is either going to start game one of a playoff series or get traded. Those are the two options for him. 3 homers over the weekend for Noelvi Marte, who returned to Cincinnati recently. Jordan, that was the weekend. I mean, we didn't even touch on the Carolina Hurricanes. We didn't barely talk World Cup. Like, there is so much sports going on right now. And College World Series is going. Like, I just don't have the bandwidth for all of this. I either need to, like, leave some things behind or get a divorce. Those are my only options.
Well, basketball and hockey is over. So you can at least, I know World Cup's not slowing down anytime soon. The one other topic I just want to make sure we mention, because the team we have not said yet, and it's relevant to what I will be working on for the next 24 hours, is the Miami Marlins took 2 out of 3 over the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I mentioned that as our last series because I'll be working on power rankings today. And the Marlins are the team that I am now starting to think, hold on a second. Do I have to take you seriously? This is especially relevant as we head towards the trade deadline with Sandy Alcantara, person and pitcher and contract that we expected to be discussing heavily leading up to the deadline. I don't think that that's suddenly different now that the Marlins have won 10 of 12 in June, but they've won four straight series. They have a fairly favorable schedule coming up, all things considered, with series against the Giants and the Rockies and the A's. I don't know, man. The Marlins, I currently have up to 17 in my power rankings. They are 500. How high could you go with them? A lot of teams floating around 500, but like, would you have them over Arizona? Probably not. Over Texas.
So you have to put them over Pittsburgh.
Over Pittsburgh? Okay, right.
They just beat them.
We would not have done that. I know, but it's sometimes I make it that simple and they have the same record, but like for 90% of the season, that would have been a preposterous notion. So I don't know.
Look, if there's one thing I know how to do, it's overreact. Okay. I would put them above Pittsburgh. I would put them above Minnesota, Houston, Boston, Detroit, Kansas City, LA, Rockies, Giants, Mets, Reds, A's, Rangers, and Diamondbacks. I would probably have them behind. That's my two cents, but you're okay. The one who does the power rankings, which is ironic because you lost power over the weekend. Jordan, we have been talking for far too long. If we want to keep talking, you can call me at 202. Not going to read the rest of my number. Shouts out to Andrew Hartz and Colin Brennan for producing. Shouts out to the Tartan Army, who hopefully keep their energy going. They need to go on the road with the Red Sox.
It didn't work. Maybe they are much better on the road.
Sox are at home this week. Sox are at home this week against the Blue Jays. Games on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Like, get out there, Tartan Army. Kilt it up. I need Jaron Duran in a kilt.
But is their next game still in Foxborough? I guess we'll have to look at that. All right, we are done. Oh, I think it is. I think it's Scotland. Yeah, Scotland and Morocco. So they are just hanging out in Boston. That's going to be a good time for them. All right, thank you to everyone who listened. BaseballBarberCast@gmail.com. We will talk to you on Wednesday. See ya.